Welcome to episode 78 of Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. My name is Adam Reichert, and with me is the other co-host, Maciek Mikulski. Hi, Maciek.
Hi, Adam. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode. Each week, we bring you a discussion on topics related to our region. And in this episode, we head back to Georgia with a look at recent political developments there. This podcast is listener-supported. Our patrons donate monthly to support the production and development of the podcast. If you would like to support us, please visit our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And don't forget to listen to the end of this episode for our traditional patron shout-out.
And Talk Eastern Europe is a member of the Europod Network, a network of European podcasts covering a range of social and political issues. Well, Maciek, we are back after a short summer break, and I'm very glad that we have our listeners here with us, so let's get started. So, Maciek, great that we are back after the summer. A lot was happening in our region, and we will definitely be covering a lot of it. But how was your summer?
Summer was busier than I expected. I participated in one interesting summer school organized by Central European University. It was about the crisis of expertise, and we're thinking about why people do not trust science and do not trust experts. So it gave me a lot of inspiration to further work. Maybe we will even have time to talk a little bit more about it in upcoming episodes, or maybe we will invite some of the colleagues and lecturers I met during the school. But yeah, but of course, I was not only working during the summer, so fortunately I had also some time to have a break, and I spent a really good vacation here in Poland.
Nice.
How about you?
Yeah, I also had quite an intense working summer, but did manage to take 2 weeks off and spent some time traveling around Sweden, camping and hiking and visiting the nature of Sweden, which was for my first time, and I really loved it, and I look forward to going back. Not in the region, so I decided to go north, but it was really good to be outdoors and with nature.
Okay. And speaking about the summer, we want to talk today about Georgia. And
yes.
It was it is still quite hot summer for this country, for the political life in this country. But it's not something really new for Georgia. Maybe I know because you did the interview, so you were also tracking the whole process for some time. So maybe tell us a bit more what we want to cover in this episode.
Yeah, there's been quite some developments in Georgia over the last year or so. I think the last time we covered Georgia on Talk Eastern Europe was in March. But just a brief kind of recap that, in October of 2020, there were elections to the parliament. The Georgian Dream Coalition won again, handedly. But the opposition claimed that they were undemocratic and had many questions about it, which led to a political crisis because the opposition refused to enter parliament. So there was never an opportunity to convene the parliament. And this led to the U.S. and especially the European Union to get involved and mediate and facilitate some sort of resolution to the crisis. Of course, at the same time, we have, global pandemic, and Georgia is not doing very well and has not done very well with the vaccination rollout, as well as it has been hit pretty hard over this time with the pandemic. But finally, around April, there was an agreement which was negotiated by Charles Michel, who is the president of the European Council. I won't go into a lot of details because we discussed it in our interview, but I think it's a very important development as it shows this important mediation role that Charles Michel and the European Union was playing in Georgia as a country that's a member of the Eastern Partnership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is interesting because judging only on the basis of our episodes since the beginning of Talk Eastern Europe on Georgia, I have an impression that the country is in kind of a permanent political, maybe crisis is a too big word, but it's really tense, yeah. And the relations between the government and the opposition are very tense. So I have an impression that there wasn't even for a while a moment in which, you know, you could say that okay, the situation is more or less stabilized, because this involvement of the European Union, which you mentioned, I agree, it is very important. Probably it's also unprecedented. I think that the European Union invested a lot of political capital to that, and the results so far are not very positive.
True.
From the point
That's
of
true.
View of the European Union. And the question is if it wasn't too big price for the EU in trying to achieve any political effect. But yeah, maybe we will talk a bit more about that after the interview, which will give you us a bit more details about that. So tell us also more about with whom you sat and with whom you discussed the recent developments.
Yes, so I sat down with Yosef Zamukashvili, who is he's a contributing policy analyst at the Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies. He's also has written for New Eastern Europe, and his latest essay, which is coming out in the September issue, it will be available very shortly online as well, covers exactly this this topic of the political crisis and where things are heading for the Georgian dream. So I asked Yosef to give us some of his input and his reactions to the situation and what might come next.
Okay, so make sure that you will also check the essay Adam mentioned. We'll put the link in the notes of this episode. And now I think simply let's listen to the interview.
Great. So joining us now is Yosef Zamukashvili, who is a policy analyst and researcher focusing on political developments in Central and Eastern Europe. He is a contributing writer for the Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies. His writings can also be found, among other places, in New Eastern Europe. And his most recent publication with NEE will be available in the upcoming issue in September, looking at the most recent developments in Georgia. Yosef, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So the last time we covered Georgia on our podcast, I think, was back in March. And this was when the political crisis was quite hot. It was when the opposition had refused to enter parliament after the elections in October. The government of the Georgian Dream Party wasn't fully ready to negotiate then yet. And then came the pressure from the outside, particularly from the United States and the European Union. So I would like to start maybe with this, with these developments. Maybe you could walk us through a little bit of the steps that were taken, especially by the EU, to achieve a resolution to the political crisis earlier this year in March and April.
So before I start talking about itself, the political crisis itself, I want to remind the listeners that everything started in summer 2019 when Gavrilo visited the parliament, and people saw that something unacceptable happened for them. And this was kind of intertwined with the ongoing political situation in the country, a dominance of one party system in the country for decades already, since the independence of the country from Soviet Union. So we move on from the first political crisis in 2019 to 2020, when elections were not recognized, let's say, as democratic by the opposition. And the main dispute basically between these parties started from here. And as the European Union saw that the political crisis was going on for so long, Charles Michel himself decided to involve himself. And he also appointed his representative, Mr. Christian Danielsson. Who was mediating. In the beginning, they were facilitating the dialogue between the parties, but then they started to mediate, and they became, let's say, the part of the side of these negotiations. So the political document itself, of course, addressed the major issues which were criticized by the society as well as the opposition parties. So first of all, it was judiciary reforms. If we visit any report of international organization about judiciary in my country, we see that there are a lot of problems, and this is not transparent. Judiciary is very politicized, and we saw the decision of these courts against several opposition party members and opposition TV owners, such as Nikanor Meliev, for instance, who was sent to the jail. And that was one of the factors as well later. So the second one is electoral reform, which Georgian has been, let's say, the civil society has been asking for since 2019, actually. The Georgian civil society, which started protests in summer 2019, they asked the government to reform it and make it, change it into a proportional system. The government agreed in the beginning, but then they adopted a mixed system, which meant that 120 people from a 150 member parliament would be chosen in a through a proportional way, whereas 30 would be elected in a majoritarian way. So that has been a problem since then. And the civil society, as well as the opposition, have been asking the government to change this reform, but they didn't do that. So the next one, which the and this document, of course, covered all of these. So the document calls for making the judiciary much more transparent, as well as electoral reforms to have, let's say, from 0 to 2% barrier at least, and also changes in electoral administration of Georgia. Because if you've seen some news, you could have heard that the head of this body, which let's say supervises the elections and organizes it, has been not very has been politicized. So the huge amount of critics was directed at her, actually, Tamer. Ms. Tamer, and she resigned now as the government started to, let's say, think about the reforms. And also the political document called for the ruling party to basically implement all the recommendations of OSCE and ODIHR on elections, and also to start genuine dialogue with the European Parliament to, let's say, have more active dialogue with the European Union in order to avoid these kind of situations in the future. And one of the most important part of this document is 43% barrier, which the government had to get in local elections, which are coming up on the 2nd of October now in autumn. But as we know, the government left the agreement, so this will not work anymore, unfortunately.
We will get into that in a moment. It was quite unprecedented, though, that the EU, and particularly Charles Michel and his representatives, were actively involved in the negotiations between the government and the opposition. But at the end of the day, the United National Movement, which is, I guess, seen as the largest opposition party right now, they didn't sign in onto the agreement, as far as I understood.
Yes.
What was their argument for not signing the agreement?
Actually, I knew that you would ask me this, so I left out the amnesty part. So that was the problem. Basically, the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement said that in the beginning, it didn't really clarify about this issue, let's say, and the clarification about Nika Melia, for instance, the leader of this party, it didn't really clarify that he had to be sent out from the jail. So they didn't sign it because of that. But second, they opted out from signing it, but they entered the parliament. And the precondition of five bullet points of the document was that all the parties should have stopped boycotting the parliament, enter the parliament and start working because the legislative had basically no credibility at all. So they entered the parliament, however, they didn't sign the document because it called for the state to have amnesty on everyone who was involved in summer protests in 2019, which included the policemen who injured people and did something really bad, basically. And they wanted to punish all these policemen who were involved in that. And that is the main reason why they didn't sign the agreement. And they had a lot of disputes inside the parliament. So it didn't really go well in the end, because as we know already, I will repeat again, the ruling party left the agreement. So that's the main reason, the amnesty part, which was not agreed thoroughly between the parties. Mm-hmm.
So that takes us, I think, to kind of the summer events, and we can look at that a little bit more closely. Maybe let's start with July, which had the far right march, which was organized in protest of the Tbilisi Pride Parade, which eventually was canceled. And the march ended with violent attacks on activists, LGBT plus activists especially, but also journalists. And these scenes were viewed globally, I think, with serious concern that the far right has received some empowerment or is getting more empowered, backed by some support with the Orthodox Church. So before we get into the later developments of the government pulling out of the agreement, how do you think we should understand these events? Was the government complicit by not protecting those who were attacked during these events?
So it's quite complicated, actually, for a person who doesn't understand the political, let's say, turmoil in this country, because these political crises are very, very complicated. The main reason why the government did that, why, let's say, it failed to support the journalists in the first place, and then of course the Tbilisi Pride, which didn't really take place after all, is that the government wanted to the government already declared that these groups, let's say the LGBT group, was associated with Mikhail Saakashvili, who is still the leader of UNM. So seeing that the support has been declining in the recent years, the government decided to use this political tool, because church is very powerful in Georgia and people are not really pro-LGBT. So the government thought, the ruling party thought, that it would be good if they label this group as the opposition, who with the European Union is trying to change Georgian culture, Georgian traditions, etc., go against church. So this way, the government tried to gain the support of people even more, and to antagonize the opposition. And as we saw, it was probably also was used by the government as an argument while leaving the agreement brokered by the EU. So in a nutshell, this is just to demonize the opposition. And by associating LGBT rights, which are not very loved in Georgia, because I think almost 80% don't really support the gay marriage in the country. And this is basically using people's sentiments to gain some political support, because as we know, Georgia is very politicized. So you either support the government or you support UNM party. Unfortunately, this is truth. the recent development, meaning the former Prime Minister Giorgi Gahare leaving the ruling party, showed that there could be a third party which could get a lot of support compared to other parties, of course. So this move is just targeted at people to change their voting behavior, let's say. That are you going to vote for the people who support LGBT groups in the country? So that's quite controversial, actually. If you listen to the statement of the current Prime Minister, Garibashvili, he at the same time says that the state has to protect these people, protect the minorities. But on the other hand, he says that LGBT pride should not exist, because he said that the march in Georgian, it's called march, let's say, only it could be that of the army of Georgia. So this is quite controversial, because I think he didn't want to say straightforward, and he couldn't do that because he would receive another wave of criticism, much harsher criticism. He already received a lot of criticism from abroad as well as from domestic civil society. But yeah, that's the main aim. And secondly, some people even think that because the support of toward Georgian Dream is decreasing, the ruling party is trying to appease to the people who are very fundamentalist and who want to who are pro-Russians at the same time, because in Georgia this is something paradoxically true, that if you are nationalist, let's say, if you are following the traditional values, you might be pro-Russian at the same time, because Russia is fighting, let's say, against the Western influence through funding these far-right groups who say that Georgian traditions are more important than European values. So this is the second reason. But the thing is that these people are just probably 3% of the population, the ones we saw in the streets on that day when they injured 54 journalists, and one died later. So that's the main reason, probably. But as I see, is that the government definitely tried to, let's say, demonize the opposition party by affiliating LGBT groups with them. Yeah.
And did they back down after the violence? I mean, did they kind of back away from this narrative after the violence that broke out?
They didn't really. After the violence, the Prime Minister made several statements, and all of them were more and more homophobic, actually. And that's something which is kind of weird. But seeing that the European Union is not really actively coercing the government in this, because it couldn't. I don't want to skip the topic. It's another question. So this is what the government tried to do, and it has had a lot of backlash in the society as well as in the media, but at the end of the day these protests end and the government got away with that so far.
Yeah, I think it also is a reflection of how polarized the society is. I mean, and cynical that the government was to, you know, like as you mentioned, to label these this as just kind of an opposition march, and they're on, you know, this is like part of another divide in try to score the political points, as you mentioned.
Exactly.
So if we move then on to basically what you came to the conclusion already that the agreement is no longer in place, that the government has pulled out of the EU brokered agreement. Has it officially announced that the agreement is over, or what has led to this point that the Georgian Dream government has basically decided that the agreement is no longer valid? Mm-hmm.
They did that on 28th of July, and they said that everything has been done already in the agreement, and the agreement couldn't bear more fruit, let's say. And it exhausted itself. This is actually what the chairman of the Georgian Dream Party said. But the main reason, of course, this is just words. The main reason is that the government has seen that it cannot probably get 43% in the upcoming local elections, and it had to back out from this agreement, because otherwise, according to the Charles Michel agreement, if they don't get 43%, they have to hold a new vote, parliamentary vote, which was considered as rigged by the opposition. So that's the main reason why they backed out. This is my opinion, but this is also the polls show the same. Probably one of the reasons why they lost the support could be Gahari leaving, the former prime minister leaving the party, and he had his own team. Let's say it's called Gahari team. They created a new party, and according to polls, it's getting quite a lot of hits. Let's say, I think in the IRI, International Republican Institute, showed that he can get around 10-13%, and these votes basically before were going to the ruling party, and now it will be, let's say, cut down. And according to the same poll, only 24% supports the ruling party. So these numbers are very low.
Wow.
And considering that, even though the ruling party says that these polls are affiliated with the opposition, they understand deep down that they are in trouble. So the only way to avoid the situation would be backing out from the agreement kind of earlier. Because if they did this in September and August, people will start talking a lot. You see, the government is backing out now before the elections, because they know that they are not going to get the necessary votes. So they did it in July. I think it was the best time, let's say, for them, because they were bargaining with the opposition, with the European Union at the same time. So they were not in the position to do that. But now they are in the position to do that. And the government also showed the opposition that it is powerful. It could intimidate people. Some people could even die, because people at the end of the day are afraid of going out to protest the ongoing situation. So I think this is what the government did. And we have to also look at the elections, what's going on in elections, because people are actually intimidated at the polls. And this is not really seen by international observers sometimes. And this is why people criticize sometimes the European Union and OSCE when they said that the elections were free. They were not really, because this is what's going on behind the background. Because some people, flamboyant people in communities, they intimidate people. They tell them that they will know if they voted for the government or not. So at the end of the day, people, normal people, let's say, they don't really want to have these problems in their communities. And we've seen recently a lot of people were killed by these people. I mean, the death rate, let's say, the criminal rate in Georgia has gone, has skyrocketed in the previous months, unfortunately, especially after the protests of these far-right groups in the street who intimidated journalists. So this is a lot of factors intertwined together. And the government is, it's information, but I know that the government is working with these criminals who were actually in jail before, put in jail by Mikhail Saakashvili government. And these people were taken out by then Prime Minister, the Tikun, Bidzinevanishvili, and these people, let's say, work for this party officially or unofficially, and they intimidate people. And we saw one, probably I talk a lot about it, and it's getting more complicated, but recently in Dmanisi, there was a fight between two, let's say, citizens. This is a place where, sorry, it was in Marneuli. This is a place where ethnic Azerbaijanis live. And the police was kind of unable, reluctant to do something there, because the government, the people who government work with, were involved in that. So they have so much power that even police is, let's say, afraid to deal with them. This is like the grassroots problem which this government, let's say, developed throughout their time in power. So yeah, that's the main issue, I think, behind that.
Yeah, it's quite concerning if we think about how the path that has been kind of taken the last, you know, year, 2 years or so. And in fact, you argue in your essay, which we will be publishing very soon, that this is a clear sign that Georgian Dream is actually backing away from its promise of Euro-Atlantic integration. But at the same time, you know, the leadership of the party claims otherwise, and they say that they have not, you know, strayed off this path. Generally, Georgians are pro-EU and pro-West, so I'm curious how, you know, some of your thoughts on how we can understand the Georgian Dream's actions in these last weeks, when we have such a strong, you know, pro-EU, pro-NATO sentiment in the Georgian society. And really, I would imagine that seeing, you know, the leaving this EU brokered agreement, not probably going in line, having policies that would be in line with what expectations are in Brussels, should affect the Georgian Dream's support and standings. I'm just curious what you think about that.
It's quite complicated, actually. We have to prioritize things here, I think, for Georgians. Mm-hmm. European integration is a priority, I think, and we've seen this throughout a lot of years, because the support towards the European Union, even though there has been a lot of criticism towards this LGBT issue, et cetera, has not really gone down. And this year, it's 75% and 74% towards NATO, I think. So the government knows that.
It's very high. Yeah, it's very high.
Yeah, it's very high compared to other countries in post-Soviet space. And the government knows it really well. And the major factor, probably we should also talk about this, why there is so much support is because of Russia. Because people, almost 80% of the population thinks that Russia is an enemy and it will undermine the sovereignty of the country. And it has done a lot of times and it's still doing through creeping occupation, which is ongoing at the moment. So they move these borders. And the people see that and they know who is good and who is the bad guy at the end of the day. And the government knows it as well. So they cannot say no to European integration, even though this is something, this is a headache for them, because this goes against their real rhetoric and their real aspiration, which is to stay in power. And this is intertwined with, of course, Bidzina Ivanishvili, a tycoon of the party, who uses all these state institutions and the state resources for his stunts, let's say, for his business interests. And these people get a lot of money, so they don't really care at the end of the day. If we visit the villages where these people live, the people who work in the government, they are quite rich. They got quite a lot of fortune in the previous years. So why would they not follow the chairman, former chairman, let's say, who left the party, but in reality he's still ruling behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I think I've discussed it also in the previous article which I published in the magazine. So the main problem here for the ruling party is the support towards the. Towards the European Union in the country, so they cannot leave this cause. But at the same time, they want to use this LGBT issue against the ruling party, because at the end of the day, this is something like a second priority of the population, of some people who think that LGBT rights, well, we should have some LGBT rights, but these people, quote-unquote, should hide in their houses and they can do whatever they can, as these people usually say, because LGBT people will not have any problems if they don't come and propagate. This is exactly what Russian President Vladimir Putin has been repeated, and this information coming to Georgia, people read these news, of course, and the government is not really against that, because at the end of the day, they can use this as a political tool against the opposition, which they've done in the previous month, as we saw. What's wrong with the European Union? This is another issue here. The problem is that the problem exists within the European Union, because the European Union cannot really use this kind of conditionality towards Georgia. It's like quasi-conditionality, what it has. It's sometimes... Says, members of the European Parliament reinstate that they are going to cut down the macrofinancial support to Georgia, which has never happened, because also at the end of the day, the European Union is afraid if Georgia will leave its orbit, and this has been trained. Belarus has gone through this recent turmoil, and I think European Union doesn't want to appear as someone strict. At the end of the day, they can't really offer Georgia more than just partnership because of the internal problems of the European Union, Hungary, Poland, and also the non-existent will between members, because these political issues are still the matter of bargaining between the governments of the member states. So not all the countries agree with opening this opportunity for Eastern Partnership countries, to as well as Georgia, of course. So at the end of the day, European Union cannot provide Georgia with more than what we have at the moment. So they try not to be very strict in their rhetoric. And at the same time, Georgian government cannot really reject European integration path, because this is also actually the way they get support. If they repeat all the time, if they appear with Charles Michel, if they go to Brussels, this is seen positively probably by some people, by their electorate, because people who don't vote for them probably already started to criticize that this is not going anywhere. We've been talking, we've been negotiating, but reforms have not been implemented, and the country has not really gone ahead towards democratization and Europeanization. What I mean, integration in with European Union. I mean, implementing more and more reforms, which would definitely result in more support from the European Union, financial or diplomatic or political, and probably the discussion about NATO membership would be much more active. But recent events showed us that European Union also has shown some reluctance, as well as NATO. They didn't even invite Georgia to Brussels summit in this year, in NATO summit, I mean. So these all things are intertwined. At the end of the day, what Georgian Dream wants to reinstate, that you see, we want to integrate with the European Union, and they already declared in February 2021 that the government is going to apply for membership of the European Union, which is out of discussion, I think, which is out of blue and has no perspective, of course. But the government still does this because they want to show the people, at least rhetorically, they want to do that, because this will give them some votes at the end of the day. And even if we look at pro-Russian parties such as Alliance of Patriots, they even include this in their party agenda, that European integration is priority for them. But at the end of the day, they visit Moscow, they negotiate with politicians there. Irma Inashvili, actually the leader of this party, usually visits Moscow. So that's quite complicated. At the end of the day, normal people, let's say, people, citizens, they don't really understand what's going on. And to hear on TV that the government is meeting someone in Brussels, and they would probably say that, yes, we are going on the right direction. Some people could be blinded like this, let's say, and they probably cannot understand what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's quite a complicated situation that you described.
There are a lot of factors. And
a lot of factors, some delicate dancing going on, and really is also somewhat of an impasse, I guess. Maybe we're kind of stuck in this cycle that, you know, without much momentum going in any direction, maybe some backsliding, if anything. So I wanted to just maybe end on one last question, which is really looking at the broader view, maybe, you know, taking a step back and broader view of Georgian politics, because you mentioned the former prime minister who has started his own party, his own movement. You know, I've always had a sense that the country is kind of stuck in this kind of bipolar situation, where the only choice is between the old United National Movement, which has Mikhail Saakashvili's shadow there, and then you have the Georgian Dream coalition, which is, you know, really run by Ivanishvili from behind the scenes, as you already mentioned. So do you think that this third option could be a true alternative for Georgian voters? If we look kind of more in longer term, is there a real opportunity here that might be developing?
The party actually is called For Georgia, the one led by Georgi Kakharia. I would be skeptical here, because These crackdowns was organized by him in the past, in 2019. So I don't really imagine a person changing so much. As people say, he has really good team behind him and he might be a good choice for someone, but not for me, subjectively, I would say, because he was the main, let's say he was the main adressant of the all the criticisms, and I've been part of these protests in 2019 as well. I don't think that this could be something new, let's say. But on the other hand, I like that there are some other parties, even though I don't agree with them, or some people might not agree with them because of their past or what they've done. It's really good because this could lead to more, let's say, much less dominant governance in the country. And civil society has been, let's say, craving for this coalition government. And if he gets similar votes as the UNM and also the ruling party, they might govern the country together. So there will be much more bargaining. In the future, which will lead to better policy decisions, probably. So this is the only positive what I see here. But I think this is a good start because we don't really have political culture, and the governments always fight with the opposition. They don't want to really go on consensus with them. So these changes really show that something new might start at least. That it can be initiated in Georgian politics, even if some good democrat, really democratic parties will not emerge in nearest future. So this is quite complicated, actually, because we have not really seen what this party has done, and we have not seen what they discussed yet. And they've been actually quite active. They visited Washington. They visited Brussels. Everything seems fine.
And will they be running in the local elections in October?
Yes, they definitely are going to do that, and because they know that they will get some support, quite high support for a new party, actually, because of followers of Georgi Gakharia, the former prime minister. So this is promising for them so far. They might get some people in top positions in local government.
Are there any other alternatives that are emerging on the scene, or any other options that have maybe a possibility to gain support?
Yes, there are other parties as well which emerged in recent years, but I don't really see them getting a lot of votes, probably in parliamentary elections, but not in local elections, so much in local elections, because let's say you cannot have two mayors in one city at the end of the day. So I think the Georgian Dream still has some, let's say, advantage in that, and they might get the highest vote still.
Okay, well, we will definitely be monitoring that. So Josef, thank you so much for joining us. I think we will probably come back to this topic in October. We will see how the results of the elections go, what kind of pressure might be put on the ruling party if they don't, even if they're out of the agreement, but they don't get 43% of the votes, that could lead to some more protest or some more pressure on Georgian Dream for a new type of resolution to the crisis. So we will be definitely keeping an eye on that. Josef, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, and we will be in touch. That was my interview with Josef Dzemukashvili, a contributing policy analyst at the Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies. You can find his latest essay in the most recent issue of New Eastern Europe, which covers the topic of a Georgian dream and whether or not it really is it's interested in the European integration path, which is declared, as we talked about in the interview. Maciek, I thought it was really interesting to hear Josef's perspective. But I think what's really important to highlight here is the fact that a couple, I think, facts. But first is the polarization, as we talked about in the interview, the polarization of Georgian society in Georgian politics is extremely high, and this is really one of the biggest barriers, I think, to any resolution to the political crisis. And then secondly is the fact that there are the local elections coming up in October, and I think it will be very interesting to see how that develops. And the fact that Georgian Dream pulled out of the agreement is probably a recognition of the fact that they will not get this 42% level of support, or they at least they're worried that they will not get this level of support. And in the agreement, if they don't receive 42% of support, then they should have new parliamentary elections, which could then, you know, just add even more chaos. But so I think these were probably the most important elements that we should be keeping an eye on for Georgia in the next months.
Mm-hmm. I would like to very briefly refer to the EU side in this, because I am also interested how do you assess it, because you know Charles Michel put a lot of effort to reach the consensus among Georgian political parties, and you know the result is we can say clearly not positive from the point of the European Union. And what does it tell us about the impact of the EU which the EU might have on the countries which are in close neighborhood of the European Union? What does it tell us about the effectiveness of all this foreign policy of the EU? And if we think for a while in a bit broader perspective, at the beginning of this year we had this situation with the high representatives of foreign affairs and security policy who visited Russia and was treated in a very bad way by the foreign minister of Russia. So I think it was a harsh lesson for the EU. Now we have another example that the EU is not able to, deliver some kinds of, effects, some kind of results on the ground. And this is part of this quite old problem that if we have countries like Georgia who were offered already visa-free regime, DCFTA, association agreement, what comes next? What the EU has in a portfolio which can attract others or the same countries more? The question is if the EU does reach its limits to attract, to impose or to use its soft power. Of course, it's not possible to answer all these questions right now in this episode, but it's that your interview gave me another reflections about that. I think we will also try to somehow discuss these problems in further episodes of Topics in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe we should even maybe look at this a little deeper in terms of the state of EU policy in the neighborhood region. And there are some questions, what's next for Eastern Partnership in general? What's the focus, and how effective is policy in the region, and what are the aims and where is it heading? So this, I think you're right that it brought some question marks. I mean, it was positive that the EU was quite involved in resolving the crisis. This is a very positive development and unprecedented, but the fact that the resolution collapsed and since then really, it's causing more problems now. So we will definitely see how that will go. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right on
that. But on the other hand, you may ask question whether Eastern Partnership countries want such involvement of the EU in their internal efforts, because this is kind of strong involvement, trying to influence internal affairs. So that's also another part of the discussion and the question about the perception of the EU in the Eastern Partnership.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, and I think we can look at other countries too. And Moldova, I think, is an interesting case that we should come back to soon, considering they had a recent change of government, which is now we have a president and a government which is declarative pro-EU, and there may be now some more attention. If things are going backward in Georgia, we might see the EU shift more attention to Moldova. So this also is interesting to see which way the winds blow and which countries get more attention from the EU in this regard.
Absolutely. Moldova deserves our attention and for sure will be discussed very soon.
Yes.
Here in Turkey, Europe.
Absolutely. Okay, so I think that we will end that part of the podcast episode. And Maciek, since we're already quite high on time, I just wanted to maybe just start with a few announcements before we end and say goodbye.
Go ahead.
First, I think, and as always, the really important part of our podcast and is the patrons that we have who are supporters of our podcast. We have a very solid group of listeners who donate financially. And I would just like to also invite all of you out there who maybe are listening to us for the first time or have listened to a few episodes. There are some benefits involved when you are when you donate to support New Eastern Europe and Talk Eastern Europe, our podcast. So I just wanted to say, one of the main benefits that is everyone gets to receive is the shout out of the podcast. So I do want to say thank you to all of our current and so we have a few new patrons as well. So I want to say hello and thank you to Agnieszka, to Tom, PM, Eleanor, Olaf, Ian, CB, Pat, Klaus, Plum, and Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, Sean, David, William, Pavo, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Erica, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Your support is incredible and we really do appreciate it. And stay tuned. Now that the summer is over, I'm sure we will begin a few exclusive events that we organize for our patrons as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. This support is essential. Without this, probably we wouldn't be able to continue, at least in such a way we do this project. And especially, it's also great that some of our patrons are with us for a very long time already.
Yeah.
I think there are also people who are since almost the beginning. So that's a huge motivation to further work. Thank you for that.
Exactly. And the last announcement I just wanted to mention, Maciek, by the time this, we are just about to release the next issue of New Eastern Europe. Maybe it's not up yet by the time we release this episode, but I do want to say stay tuned for that. We have a special theme we have a special issue, which is the main theme is on Belarus, looking at Belarusians 1 year in protest. We have articles. We have an interview with Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. So I think that's quite interesting to read, an exclusive interview there, as well as many, many essays and articles on the situation in Belarus, what might happen next. And I do encourage all of you to check it out. You can just visit us online at www.neweasterneurope.eu.
For those listeners who do not know us, maybe this is also a good time to remind that or to say that last year we also produced a special documentary series about Belarus.
Yes.
It was about 10 episodes, if I remember correctly. So I think some of the episodes are still worthy listening because it was not only about covering the crisis, but also about Belarus, the history of the country, history of the nations, of the nation, and language, culture. Yeah, please have a look on our profile. You will find it easily. The title of the series is "The Story of Belarus."
Definitely worth checking out, and definitely still very relevant. So if you haven't listened to it, highly recommend it. Excellent, absolutely. Okay, Maciek, so I think that's all we have for our listeners today. I just would like to thank everybody for joining us, and we will be back very soon with more episodes of Talk Eastern Europe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.